In the cinematic sea of prequels, sequels, reboots, and reimaginings, the Movie Retakes podcast considers the merits and desires for Hollywood's new takes on our beloved movie classics. Brothers Matt and Chris Sully examine the latest retake franchises, pitch their own original retake visions, and share their love for the movies that made them.
Hey everybody, welcome to Movie Retakes. This is Matt Sully.
And big brother Chris Sully.
It's been a couple years since we used this stuff. I hope it still works.
It should. Power cells have a half-life of 5,000 years.
There's no time for a bench test. Heat them up.
Do. Ray.
Egon.
Today's episode is all about Ghostbusters. So we've got Ghostbusters 1, 2, and we're going to cover a little bit of Ghostbusters Afterlife.
On this week's episode, we've got all kinds of fun stuff coming your way, including... Who's the biggest prick actor of the 80s films? What did Barack Obama say about Harold Ramis? Who's the biggest ambassador for the Ghostbusters franchise? Which children's television icon was almost the villain in Ghostbusters? And be sure to stay tuned. Later in the episode, we've got a secret code word for you for a future giveaway. So pay attention and have a pen on standby to write that down.
Secret. Yeah, wherever you're listening to this right now, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. And if you're not following us over on Twitter, please do. We've been having a lot of fun over there with our fans already. The giveaways will probably come through that as well. So please follow wherever you can and subscribe. All right, so we've got a lot in this episode today, but I do want to talk a little bit about what we've been watching. I'd like to cover stuff that we've been streaming, essentially. I always say, what are you watching on television? But who's, you know, there's a television there, but it's basically a monitor for what you're streaming, right?
Yeah, the whole terminology is just hung around. Like, I'll still say to this day, record something. Mm. It's really a DVR. There's no tape involved. There hasn't been in a decade.
Yeah.
Or more at this point.
Yeah. So what are you watching these days?
You know, I've been staying plenty busy. Got a lot of free time. I've been doing a lot of running, and that I got to have something in my ear holes while I'm running, or else I go nuts and I'll think about it too much. But as far as movies and TV streaming stuff goes, just wrapped up Future Man season 3, which I believe was the finale of the entire series. Really well done show. Love it. Westworld season 3 is well underway, and boy, what a nice return to form, I think, that season 3 has been over season 2. Watched the movie Guns Akimbo over the weekend with Harry Potter himself, Daniel Radcliffe, and that one is very interesting premise. If you haven't, I would highly recommend you watch the trailer, especially if you're a friend of like Scotty P., Scott Pilgrim versus the World. I would, I think this might be up your alley. Just a little bit more blood and guts involved, but
yeah, anything Edgar Wright style. I like that sort of thing when handled correctly. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. You'd think it would drive you nuts with all the jumping around, but somehow they still maintain a linear storytelling with that. That's just wow. I love it. I don't know who directed this Guns Akimbo. I got to go back and look. It was not Edgar Wright. I would have known that. But last week, Tonight with John Oliver. You got me hooked on that. Love that. No one goes on a 25-minute rant like John Oliver, and I honestly feel like I've gotten more of an education from him than I did in 4 years of college. Tales from the Loop on Amazon Prime. I started that, but was very distracted by my phone and realized I was being a bad viewer, so I'm going to go back and start that over because I hear wonderful things about that. A lot of comparisons to Stranger Things by the people that say they're enjoying it. And then Amazing Stories. There are 4 or 5 episodes out now on Apple Plus TV or Apple TV Plus, whatever they're calling that, their service. Yeah. And the first episode was great. The others were meh. And then I just watched one last night called The Rift that is very good. That reminds me more of the original Amazing Stories program than any of the other episodes. Podcasts. I've been listening to Mark Maron, WTF, my brother and me. Those guys crack me up. Movie Jungle from our good friend Jungle Bry, Brian. And I was just featured along with my co-founder of Nerd Foo, my good buddy Steve, on the Secondary Heroes podcast. We had a nerd reunion because we hadn't podcasted together for a while. So I'm featured over there this week with him. And then games. I love gaming. I've been doing my own streaming on my Mixer channel under the name McCracken5, which is my gamer tag. Not confusing at all when you're trying to find me. Mm. But I've been playing a lot of Animal Crossing. That is highly addictive. I couldn't tell you why, but I'm still playing it and I'm enjoying it. I just downloaded the Call of Duty Modern Warfare Warzone, which, pro tip, absolutely free on Xbox and I believe PC right now. So I've been playing the hell out of that. I like it. That may get me to buy the entire new Modern Warfare game. And then the age-old, tried-and-true, I can't stop playing it. I play it every day, thanks to your wife, Candy Crush. I'm on like a 7 or 8 year streak at this point of playing Candy Crush.
That is amazing.
Insane is what I'd call it, but somehow I keep going back. I just can't stop.
You got the sweet tooth.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Too clever. Sorry, everybody.
Because candy.
I'll see myself out. Yeah, I've been watching Westworld too, but I keep watching it too late at night. And honestly, it's one of those shows that needs your focus. Like you've got to pay attention. I'm liking it. I've been thinking about. I'm not sure how much more I want to see the story. Like I don't know. I'm more interested when that first episode was all Aaron Paul. I was more interested in his story when it actually got to the point where What's-Her-Face came along. I'm like, okay. But I was more interested in what he was up to just by itself, you know? Like this idea of other stories going on while she's out trying to take over the world or whatever nonsense. I mean, it's still fun, but there's some things that I kind of miss about actually being in the park and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know where they're going to go, and I'll still watch it, and I'm enjoying it and everything. But yeah, I think I kind of... feels to me like it kind of needs to wrap up. It's not the kind of show that I want to carry on for many more seasons.
Ooh, I doubt HBO is going to let that happen. That one's their mainstay now.
Yeah. We did rewatch and finish Breaking Bad. Still just a superb show. If you haven't watched that one, I highly recommend going out and watch that. Been watching that show Happy, which is crazy. It's insane. It's so weird, and I love it.
Same.
Kingdom. It's like this medieval Korean zombie thriller show, which also sounds crazy, but it's really good. The effects are really good. It's got some nice drama in there, but these are the fast zombies, and it's a lot of fun. If you're into any zombie show at all, I would actually highly recommend this one. Rewatched Real Genius, The Witches of Eastwick. Yes. Which I never really thought about George Miller directing anything other than Mad Max, but he directed Witches of Eastwick and a couple of other really good things. I think that one kind of got dismissed a little bit, but you should probably go back and watch that. It's got some pretty good folks in it. I was just looking up George Miller, what else he directed here. Oh yeah, really strange stuff. I'm not going to go on too much, but I just want to mention that this guy directed the Mad Max movies, and he also directed Babe, Pig in the City, and Happy Feet. What?
What?
You couldn't be on more opposite ends of the spectrum with that subject matter. How strange.
I'm 99% positive, too. At one point, a decade, 15 years ago, they were bringing him in to make a Justice League movie.
Oh, interesting.
And he did a bunch of research and even, I think, some screen tests and designed some stuff, and then it all fell apart.
Huh. What he's done is pretty good stuff. Also watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the original movie, not the series. Still good. And these are kind of offshoots from the subject matter. Real Genius I watch because of Atherton, and Buffy the Vampire I watch because of Paul Rubens, because they knew... oops, I ruined the trivia. we'll cut that part out. I watched The Fourth Kind, which is not a lot of people I think saw that, but it's like a alien abduction sort of movie. They took a bit of a risk there with this whole found footage sort of thing, which I actually think it didn't work out as well. The stuff where they're just the normal fictional part of it is way better, and I don't think it works as well with the found footage. But anyway, still a very entertaining movie. Watch World War Z, rewatch on that one. I love that movie, another zombie sort of thing. And Onward, which I'm a big Pixar fan, but that one was a flop for me. I can't recommend it. I didn't really enjoy it. I don't know what happened there. But if you do are interested in what we've been watching, we're on Letterboxd app. It's Letterboxd. And basically just keeping a diary there, or whatever the manlier version of that would be, a journal of our movie watching experience. And so if you're interested in what we're watching, that'll be on there as well. And so a couple other apps, though, we keep talking about these movies and shows and stuff. And if you want to watch along or are interested where you could be seeing them, realgood.com, R-E-E-L, good.com, and justwatch.com will show you. You can look and I think add your regional area as well to say, you know, where do I watch Ghostbusters or where do I watch Kingdom or Buffy or whatever. And it will show you what's available where you are or where to rent or buy them as well.
Yeah, those sites are very helpful. A listener, Ben, cued us in on that. I thought I should trust my Apple TV and I'll put the button, he'll hold the button down and say, hey, you know, Ghostbusters. And it'll come up and say, you can rent it here. Like, hold up, hold the phone. Is it available for free or on another service I'm already paying for and you guys just want to make another quick $3 off of me? And sure enough, sometimes you can find out that it's on another streaming service that you have access to. Or in the time that we have right now, a bunch of these services like HBO and Epix and there's a couple others are offering free content right now. So you definitely want to do your due diligence before you shell out your hard-earned cash.
Yeah. So we do have a special segment today. I'd be remiss if I didn't take some time out to talk about Harold Ramis, since he's no longer with us. Harold Ramis died in 2014 at age 69 as a comedic writer and performer. He started with the Second City Performers in Chicago, then went on to several National Lampoon's projects, including National Lampoon Radio Hour with Bill Murray and John Belushi, National Lampoon Show with Gilda Radner, Christopher Guest, and Joe Flaherty. He was the head writer of SCTV from 76 to 79. He helped write Animal House, Meatballs, Stripes, Back to School, Ghostbusters 1 and 2, and Caddyshack, which was his directorial debut. He later directed the first National Lampoon's Vacation, Bedazzled, Multiplicity, Analyze This and Analyze That, the sequel, and Groundhog Day. In 2009, he had planned to make a third Ghostbusters, and whether you blame Dan Aykroyd's crazy script or Bill Murray's non-committal attitude for the movie's standstill, I'm sure it would have been great, and I wish we'd gotten to see the real Dr. Egon Spengler one more time. Upon Ramis's death, President Barack Obama released a statement saying, when we watched his movies, from Animal House and Caddyshack to Ghostbusters and Groundhog Day, we didn't just laugh until it hurt. We questioned authority. We identified with the outsider. We rooted for the underdog. And through it all, we never lost our faith in happy endings.
Wow. That is an amazing resume. And I didn't realize that was all him until you were reading through that. That is so much of my childhood. Like, I grew up on his comedy and Bill Murray's comedy, and I think that shaped the type of humor I like. Probably you as well, being just 3 years difference. I think that that was our childhood.
Yeah,
and I love that he was such a big part of that.
So we are covering Ghostbusters, and we're going to talk about Ghostbusters 1 and 2, just to give you a little bit of background. Hopefully you've seen these, but if not, we're going to give a little bit of detail about that, and then we're going to just kind of talk about what we think after our recent rewatch of them.
I would say spoilers ahead, but it is 2020. If you have not seen Ghostbusters 1 and 2, I think the statute of limitations is far run out on that. Plus, why did you hit play on a podcast titled Movie Retakes-Ghostbusters? Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, I don't know. If you haven't seen it by now, I'm sorry, but go watch it.
Let's do a quick recap of the whole movie from start to finish.
Yeah,
how's that?
We'll start reading from the opening line. What is the opening line to Ghostbusters? I don't know. Three former parapsychology professors set up shop as a unique ghost removal service. The actors in this are Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Harold Ramis, Ernie Hudson, Sigourney Weaver, Rick Moranis, Annie Potts, and William Atherton. William Atherton, I have here, he's like the go-to prick of the 80s, which is what led me, after watching Ghostbusters, to go watch Real Genius, because he's a total jerk in that. He's like the science professor and kind of their lead over their project. He's also in Die Hard as that a-hole reporter that goes after the story. Goes to their house, right? And like talks to the kids that are still there about what's happening. And then she punches him at the end, I think, of that movie.
I was going to say, he's really lucky that all she did was punch him and that they didn't pull one of those loose weapons lying around and finish him off.
Yeah. But he shows up in the second one too, isn't he? He's like in one of the planes that's circling around. Yeah. Yep. So we loved to hate him so much that we brought him back.
Everything was fine with our system until the power grid was shut off by Dickless here.
They caused an explosion. Is this true?
Yes, it's true. This man has no dick.
He's really good at being a prick.
Yeah, he is. So Ghostbusters is directed by Ivan Reitman, who also directed Meatballs, Stripes, Twins, Kindergarten Cop, which is my wife's favorite movie, Evolution, and he's going to be directing the upcoming Triplets, which is the sequel to Twins. If you haven't seen any of those, you need to go watch them. Be honest, Meatballs is a bit, I don't know, it's all right. It's got a few laughs. It's not an outstanding film, but it's worth it just for watch, you know, to see that early Bill Murray sort of behavior. He's just an oddball. Stripes is a good movie. It's one of those strange ones where it hits like a halfway mark and it kind of changes the tone of the movie. Like it's all this the training and then they actually go to battle and it's a bit odd in the end, but also worth a watch. It's pretty good. So this came out. And the writers for Ghostbusters were Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis. This came out in 1984 amid Beverly Hills Cop, The Karate Kid, Police Academy, Footloose, Romancing the Stone, Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. Where you at, Spock? And Splash. that was the alternate title, Spock. Star Trek III. Where you at, Spock?
Woohoo, Spock!
Where you be? Ghostbusters comes out June 8th, 1984, and Gremlins is released the same weekend. Dang. Oh, man. Dang. I wonder which one we went to go see first. Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom was already out in its third week. Ghostbusters beat both of those that weekend and was in the number one spot for 7 consecutive weeks after that. It was in second place for highest gross that year behind Beverly Hills Cop, and really only by like $5 million. From a $30 million budget, it earned $295 million worldwide. That's amazing. Good for them. Still loved, great rating, Rotten Tomatoes, 97%. And I couldn't agree more.
Well deserved.
Yeah. And when it came out, it was a hit right away too. Like critics liked it. Audiences liked it. It was one of these first comedies that had really expensive and elaborate special effects. That wasn't a thing that they tended to spend money on with comedies. They felt like it had a limited value for audiences, where it was sort of almost throwaway humor, where, you know, we'd make a little bit of money, but they didn't really spend a ton of money on these things. It was one of the only films to create an independent and recognizable icon with the Ghostbuster symbol, the theme song by Ray Parker Jr., which was a number one hit, all that gear, the Ecto-1. I mean, they're all such recognizable items. If you were to go anywhere in the world right now and show them the Ghostbuster symbol with the, you know, little knot symbol through it and the, you know, the ghost popping out of the, everybody would know what that is. It's as known as McDonald's, yeah. I think.
Needs no translation, and one of the only movie that I can think of that is recognizable so easily by a simple icon without the title. I mean, you think about other famous like fonts for Back to the Future, things like that. It makes sense, but it still needs a translation in other languages. The emblem does not. Maybe Batman, 89 Batman's one of the only ones that you can get away with that, and you know exactly what it is you're looking at. But even that was established long before the film.
Right.
Ghostbusters made that for this movie. That's very interesting to me that no other film has done that in the same way.
Yeah, it really hasn't. I mean, that's impressive. They came up with all this just for the movie, like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. Came up with, well, I mean, all this stuff, but the proton packs, the concepts of catching ghosts in these devices and storing them in a machine like that, like who, that's very original. And it's weird how you immediately are comfortable. They introduce the concepts and you're like, okay, yeah, that makes perfect sense. You're like, you show just a little bit of how it works and you're like, yeah, okay, I agree. I can do this.
I buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. And it's a great blend too. Like these guys, their gadgets and stuff are fancy, but they're also these sort of cobbled together machinery where you believe that these guys who what was it? Dan Aykroyd's character ends up like with a third mortgage on his house just to fund this thing.
At 20% or something.
Yeah, he didn't even negotiate. Yeah, who doesn't have a third mortgage on their house these days? But they're in like jumpsuits and stuff. They get that old beat up car that was like a hearse or something that they converted.
Yeah.
And I like that sort of down to earth thing that like a lot of people can relate to, you know, starting your own business. And this is just kind of where it begins. And then they, you know, hit it big, I guess. Well, they get a lot of work. They didn't really get a lot of respect at the end, but they get a lot of work. So Ghostbusters 2, 5 years later, is the discovery of a massive river of ectoplasm and a resurgence of spectral activity allows the staff of Ghostbusters to revive the business. And so basically what I was alluding to there is after Ghostbusters, with the initial sort of, you know, downtown celebration of them saving the city, at least, they're immediately dismissed as frauds, pretty much, and set to the background. They don't have any more work. The ghosts are all gone, and 5 years later, what they're reduced to entertaining at children's parties, right?
Yeah, and not even really wanted, but hired.
Yeah, exactly.
Down and we'll have fun.
Yeah.
You know, my dad says you guys are full of crap.
Jason.
Well, some people have trouble believing in the paranormal.
No, he just says you guys are full of crap and that's why you went out of business.
Song.
Come on, everybody. The stuff is strange in the neighborhood.
Let's go get a beer. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this has all the same folks from the first one. William Atherton's not in it though, and we get Peter McNichol instead as the sort of resident weirdo who runs the museum, or at least is that part of the cleaning services or whatever. This is also directed by Ivan Reitman, also written by Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis. There's a lot of consistency there, and you can tell in the cast and the treatment of this. You feel comfortable in that world when you come in. We've covered the year in movies back in the Bill and Ted episode. Just as a recap, the Batman, Back to the Future 2, Last Crusade were the biggest hits of that year, grossing over $300 million worldwide. Ghostbusters 2, on a $25 million budget, hit $215 million in the box office. So still quite good, but was not as well received by critics or audience, and it retains a 53% on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's a little harsh, I think.
It is.
But, you know.
Yeah, so we've rewatched this. What do you think after rewatching them again? What do you think of the first one, the second?
Well, yeah, definitely. Ghostbusters to me has never slipped a bit. I remember seeing it as a kid, and you know, I think it's interesting to note that when Ghostbusters 1 and 2, for that matter, came out, that the world was very different when it came to movies. I remember Ghostbusters being on. We saw it somewhere around opening weekend. I think it came out in June, and then I'm pretty sure we saw it again like 6 months later at the theater. It was still on. The fact that you said it retained first place for 7 weeks, no movie does that now. Even the biggest blockbusters like Endgame, a month later, they're already at a dollar theater, and then a month after that, you can already buy them on DVD, Blu-ray, whatever. You can rent them digitally on your Apple TV or whatever device. It was very different then. You know, you'd wait, it would be on at the theater forever, and then like a year later, it might come out on video, and like 4 years later, you might catch it on HBO or Showtime. Just a very different time. But I loved the original Ghostbusters. Holds up just exactly how I remember it. I love every second of that movie. Ghostbusters 2, I haven't watched as much, but definitely still enjoy it. And I think that 53% is pretty harsh. To me, it you know, if Ghostbusters 1 is a 10, Ghostbusters 2 is like an 8. I don't think it slipped off that bad.
Yeah. No, I agree. It had been a little while since I watched Ghostbusters 2, and I know that it was not as good as the first one, but
yep.
I don't think it's as bad as a 53%. Like, I think it has some value. I do know that in the research here, it did go through a lot of reshoots. Original test audiences were, I guess, worse than that. Just they had a lot of stuff they needed to clean up. There were some questions about audiences didn't understand that the goo could be positively and negatively charged. Like, they didn't really understand that concept. So when you had the big finale or whatever, they didn't quite get what the heck was going on. They had a whole thing where they also just didn't have enough scares, enough of the spooky stuff. So much of it was about the relationship with Bill Murray and Sigourney Weaver, which it still is. But apparently that just was 90% of the movie, and it took up too much. Like, they just didn't have enough of the actual villain and the ghost. And it's a weird thing. Like, the villain is still a little bit off to me because he's essentially stationary. He stays in the museum. We've got, you know, maybe the closest thing was Janosch there, Peter McNichol, who goes off as sort of a minion of his. But even then, he kidnaps the baby. But that's about it. He even stays at the museum. There's the goo that runs underneath the city that's really reactionary to all the negative vibes. New York, as it often is treated by anybody who does movies in New York, is its own character, where the people are the ones that sort of set the tone. And it ends up being, you know, New York is the one who has to overcome all the negativity, and the people have to come together and rise to the occasion to defeat the villain along with the Ghostbusters. And so that's interesting, but at the same time, it kind of creates some confusion amongst, you know, who are we really fighting here and what is actually happening. I think they could have handled some stuff better. I would have liked to seen a bit more resistance in them getting together after the 5 years hasn't treated them well. And, you know, they're all pretty much, they're not all failures. Basically, Egon's still doing all right. He's got some research stuff where he's locking married couples in the hot room and pissing them off and giving little girls puppies and stuff to check, you know, and that ties into the whole emotional thing of the story. But anyway, overall, still worth a watch. If you're going to watch these, and we don't really talk about the Ghostbusters Answer the Call, the 2016 one, because the Ghostbusters Afterlife, when we get to that, doesn't consider it part of the canon, I guess, where this is supposed to be a sequel to pick up basically after Ghostbusters 2. So we're going to go 1, 2, and then Afterlife. So we're not really going to cover that.
As God intended.
Yeah. I did look at that too. Like, the Ghostbusters Answer the Call has 74% on Rotten Tomatoes, which,
come on,
is a bold-faced lie.
Yeah, come on.
Yeah, no. What were you gonna say?
Yeah, four people in their basement reviewed that. That's why. Mm-hmm. Wait, the math doesn't add up on that. Like, 8 people. I made some notes. When I go through and watch the films, I really like phone down, full focus. I'm looking not only for another fun interaction with these films when we do a review and do the podcast, but I'm looking at details I maybe didn't focus on before. And I'll pick up my phone from time to time to make a quick note. So my ideas here are kind of bulleted out through the two films, but I picked up on some interesting things. Ghostbusters 1, the practical effects were top-notch. They definitely integrated some technology, some special effects with their proton packs, with the ghosts. But the way they used the library books and the cards and the opening scenes, Dana's chair sliding into the kitchen in her apartment, the eggs popping out of the egg carton and then cooking on the counter, I loved all that. And I think anytime practical effects can be used, I am more of a fan. I think it looked fantastic. And then, of course, they had to do something with the ghosts. They couldn't not show them. So there are a few times where the movie shows its age, but I'm still perfectly fine with that. Not nearly as bad as some other films that I've rewatched. Interesting note here. Dana and everyone else in New York seem to just jaywalk all the time. I've been to New York several times, and people don't walk like this. Maybe they did in the 80s. I didn't go in the 80s. But like her opening scene, she straight up jaywalks in front of a car, almost gets hit, and doesn't even recognize that it's happening. She kind of glances at the car. Like, we could have lost her really early on in the film.
That would have
been kind of fruitless. Yeah, they just kill her off, and she becomes a ghost. I guess it would be the only way that would work.
Jeez.
As you referenced earlier, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man is a big part of the film, and I did not realize until one of these most recent viewings that he appears earlier in the film. In that scene where the eggs pop out of the container and cook on the counter, you can actually see a Stay Puft Marshmallow bag on the counter, which I didn't question this as a kid, but are Stay Puft Marshmallows real? Were they real in the 80s?
No, I don't think so. I think it was made up just for the movie.
Interesting. But I bet now you can buy them somewhere, whether or not they're a collectible or they're a real thing. I don't know. Should look that up.
Yeah.
Where does that siren noise for Ecto-1 come from? That is a very iconic sound, but not one that I recall hearing anywhere else. Maybe in British films or something. Is it like an ambulance in Britain?
Yeah, I think that probably is. It's like a British ambulance or police siren or something.
Gotta be really weird for a Ghostbusters fan over there. Meanwhile, our heroes are rolling around in a repurposed hearse. Interesting choice. Yeah. But they were balling on a budget. I get it. So,
yeah, it looks cool.
The Slimer scene. Everyone knows the first introduction of Slimer.
Come in, Ray.
Pittman! I saw it!
It's right here, Ray. It's looking at me.
He's an ugly little spud, isn't he?
I think he can hear you, Ray.
Don't move. It won't hurt you. Batman, what happened? Are you okay?
He slimed me.
That's great. Actual physical contact. Can you move?
Ray, come in, please.
I feel so funky.
Rewatch that. It's iconic. Nothing has changed. It's amazing. But what I did notice on this go-around is when the team turns and fires their proton packs and just demolish that cleaning cart, the poor little old lady that's cleaning the hotel is now, I'm looking in the background, and she is focused on a flaming roll of TP, trying to put it out with some sort of cleaning solution. And I was laughing my butt off at that. Like, I never noticed her back there before, trying to put out the fire.
Yeah, it's weird how many times you can watch these movies, because I must have seen that like 15, 20 times or something before. And those little details that somehow you just missed every other time. You mentioned the Stay Puft in the bag. He's also shows up in a billboard at some point in an earlier scene. So, I mean, they were trying to clue us into the existence of him in that world early on. It's pretty clever.
I did not catch the billboard. I got to go back and look for that. Good catch. There were some cameos by Casey Kasem, who I grew up listening to on the radio on the weekends. He already always had the big countdown of the most popular songs in the U.S. And Larry King,
yeah,
a younger Larry King, because he's like 400 years old. So, you know, this wasn't that much younger, but he definitely looked a lot younger.
Yeah, this is before they had to like duct tape him to a broom handle and hold him up with like strings and stuff. Pretty sure he's just a puppet.
I'm pretty sure
at this point
his shirt and tie are stiff and he just kind of oozes into it. Yeah. Some iconic lines, and one of my favorites that I still wonder to this day if it was a paid placement or something ad-libbed was when Zeta Moore says, that's a big Twinkie.
What do you mean the big? Well, let's say this Twinkie represents the normal amount of psychokinetic energy in the New York area. According to this morning's sample, it would be a Twinkie 35 feet long, weighing approximately 600 pounds.
That's a big Twinkie.
Just that whole scene cracks me up. So iconic.
Yeah. No, that's true. And there's plenty more one-liners in the first one. And a ton of that was ad-lib stuff. The second one doesn't have quite as many, but it's still pretty funny. And I think Peter McNichol does a great job there. It's good to have Rick Moranis back as Tully. Annie Potts is good. And yeah, it's those supporting characters from the first one especially that are so solid. Like, you get a really good idea of who they are, and their lines make sense and stuff. And yeah, they're very funny on their own. And then especially when they interact with the main guys there, then it's that much better.
That's a perfect segue into my next bulleted item from Ghostbusters 1, and that is Lewis Tully and the ongoing gag of him locking himself out of his apartment. I love that in the few seconds we have with him prior to him being repurposed as a hellhound, you get a sense of who he is. I love that ongoing gag. I love the party that he hosts where we see him a little bit.
I was just exercising. I taped 20-minute workout on my machine and played it back at high speed, so it only took 10 minutes. I got a great workout.
His part,
I think that's great.
His part in the second one was actually bigger. They had an ongoing thing where Slimer kept coming in and eating his food or something. Like Slimer,
really?
Yeah, Slimer hung out at the fire station more in the second one. Because there's a whole thing where basically the real Ghostbusters cartoon that was going on from 86. 1986 during this time was so successful that they when they're making this movie, they wanted to cater to the kids that were watching that cartoon, and so they wanted to feature Slimer more, and so they had an ongoing thing where basically it was a rivalry or whatever between Tully and Slimer, and basically building up Tully's character to finally have the showdown with Slimer, and then where at the end, you know, he's the one who he feels like he's cracked the shell of the goo that's all over the museum. So that was kind of a more ramped up side story that they chopped off. They cut away from the actual final cut.
Tully needed a spinoff film. That was not a thing at the time, really. It would have been interesting to see some development of that character.
Oh, that would be awesome. Yeah, Ghostbusters, right? Tully.
Tully and Slimer. the award-winning team.
That would be good.
Yeah, another classic line from Tully. Okay, who brought the dog?
Yeah.
Dude, that's not a dog. How stupid are you? Have you been to a zoo, right? There's no animal on this planet that looks quite like that thing. What is wrong with you?
Yeah.
I keep saying the word iconic, but this film is from start to finish as iconic as it gets. I mean, this is going to go down as one of the top 10 films of my life easily forever. Is that montage? There's that montage right when the containment unit is shut off by Supreme Dick. That the music, the special effects of the lights blasting into the sky, the montage of the different ghosts that we get to see throughout the city and the way that people are seeing them for the first time and interacting with them, and just all that. That is something you cannot look away from when it's on the screen. It is just so, so good.
Yeah.
I love that part.
And you're right that the effects and everything, for the most part, still hold up and are still very effective. And not only are they very good, because most of them were, you know, practical real world effects, they weren't CG or anything, but there's a difference between that first film and the second one in the treatment of the ghosts and the movie itself, where the first one, there's some moments of genuine fear. Like it is menacing, it is very upsetting. Like, you're watching this and you feel what they want you to feel, where this is like end of the world, terribly devastating stuff that's happening.
Well, you could believe Mr. Pecker.
My name is Peck.
Or you could accept the fact that this city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
What do you mean, biblical?
What he means is Old Testament, Mr.
Yes.
Mayor. Real wrath of God type stuff.
Exactly.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Enough, I get the point.
And they're even like... Zed, you know, Ernie Hudson is referencing like the biblical passages and stuff with Dan Aykroyd in the car, where, you know, the moon became sackcloth or whatever. I can't quote it, but anyway, it is genuinely frightening. And then the second one doesn't have that same feel. Like, I never feel like we're genuinely in danger or the people are genuinely in danger.
No, it felt, boy, how do you, not candy coated. It felt kind of padded, kind of dumbed down a little bit. Not as raw.
Yeah. If anything, it should have gone the other direction. It should have ramped it up. And the second one should have been even scarier than the first one, I think. But that's not...
Yeah, for sure.
But that's like what I was talking about with catering to the kids who were watching the cartoon. That they went the exact opposite route on purpose.
Well, we can see by the box office that maybe that wasn't the right choice.
Yeah.
And then I forgot about this until I'm watching it alone. But when the guys get sent to prison and they're going over their plan on the map and all the other guys, well, in jail, not prison. In jail, the other guys are like getting in, like watching. He's like, you getting all this? I love that scene. Reginald Vell Johnson, the most famous movie policeman of all time, probably, appears. And if you don't remember, Reginald Vell Johnson is the guy who ended up playing the cop in Die Hard. Again, a reference to a Twinkie. Interesting.
Oh,
just put that together. But Reginald Vell Johnson, I had to look this up. I've wondered this for many, many years. That was the first time that he portrayed a cop in a film. He went on to play a cop in Die Hard, as I already referenced, Turner and Hooch, the TV show Family Matters, Perfect Strangers, and more. Found an article on U.S. News that says, to date, he has now played a cop 8 times in movies and television shows, and I'd be willing to bet we haven't seen the last of that gag in Reginald Vell Johnson's life, so that number's probably going
to
go up.
He needs to do one more where there's also mention of Twinkie, so then it'll be like the Cornetto trilogy. This will be the Twinkie trilogy, and then we'd have it all put together. So please do that.
I love it.
If you're listening, somebody hire this man and give him a Twinkie.
I ever make a film, I'm going to hire Reginald Vell Johnson to come in for a cameo as a police officer somewhere in it. If I make multiple, he'll be in every one of them. I think that would just in the background, like in a window eating a Twinkie or like leaning out a window or, you know, in a crowd, whatever.
And if you watch that the Movies That Made Us episode that handles Ghostbusters, that man's just a sweetheart. Like it focuses on him quite a bit because he was about to give up acting and Die Hard. He got the job in Die Hard and was just so thrilled. He wanted his mom to see it or something. What did she get to, or she died or something before that, didn't she?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly how that story went down, but something along
it was
those
sad.
Lines. Like yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he seems like a sweetheart for sure. I'd like to meet him. I'm surprised to have not seen his name at any of the conferences, the Comic-Cons that I go to. I didn't mention it before, but talking about Winston Zeddemore, played by Ernie Hudson. Ernie Hudson is at a lot of the conventions and has been for years, as long as I've been going. I started going in 2012, 2013. I've seen him at many. I've never sadly gone in his line and gotten an autograph or a photo. I should do that. Because we don't know how long we'll have these guys. But he is always very, very, I guess, appreciative of his fame from the film. And he always, they put his table near an Ecto-1 that somebody's, decked out an old hearse to look like it. He signs a lot of autographs, poses in a lot of photos. And anyone I've talked to who's met him has said he is indeed a sweetheart.
Do you believe in UFOs, astral projections, mental telepathy, ESP, clairvoyance, spirit photography, telekinetic movement, full trance mediums, the Loch Ness Monster, and the theory of Atlantis?
If there's a steady paycheck in it, I'll believe anything you say.
You could tell. With some people, you see them and you're like, yeah, he's a nice guy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think he probably, since he's the only one that regularly does the cons from that cast, I feel like he's got to be probably the best ambassador for the Die Hard franchise out of all those guys. I mean, the rest will do the big celebrity TV interviews and podcasts or whatever, but I feel like he's putting boots to the ground with the real fans, you know?
The Ghostbusters? You said Die Hard.
Did I?
Yeah. Oops. Whatever. I know what you meant.
I looked up on my screen. Did you not know he was in Die Hard?
He should have been. Should have been a lot more.
That would have been great.
I like Ernie Hudson a lot.
He could have been the third Johnson.
You two brothers? No.
No. And then finally from the first Ghostbusters, the classic line, are you a god? If anybody asks if you're a god, you say yes. So good.
Good rule of thumb, listeners. If anybody ever asks you that, yes, you are a god.
So Ghostbusters 2, I feel like right off the get-go, they were really trying hard to establish that some time had passed, because they slap us in the face with a big, bold print 5 years later. I mean, there was no debate. We were in 1989 at this point.
Yeah. Well, and it was actually 5 years later in real life, so it didn't really make any like, yeah. Why did we need that? I don't know. We could have figured it
they
out.
They knew that we'd be dissecting this years later, and it would be an important note. That's what it was. Yeah. They were getting ready for the Movie Retakes podcast. There's a reference early on to Starman, another great sci-fi movie, definitely not a comedy, from 1984, starring the immortal, the amazing Jeff Bridges and Karen Allen. And I did not know this, but Starman, directed by John Carpenter. I found that out when I was doing my research. I had no clue.
Yeah, he's great.
Interesting.
I love John Carpenter.
Good movie. Maybe a hint to a future Movie Retakes episode, because Starman could have some legs these days. There's some interesting things going on there.
That's true. Been a while since
another
I've seen
great quote from Ghostbusters 2 from the man himself, Egon. We had part of a slinky, but I straightened it.
Yeah, that, I love that it's just part of one. Like, what happened to the rest of it? Well, he was using it for something?
Yeah. Wait, he had no toys? Where did he get this one? Did he, like, dig it up somewhere? Did another kid, like, throw it out by the curb because it was trash and he picked it up? Yeah. How much work does it take to straighten a slinky? Going on to the Parkview Hospital scene where the guys are put under psychiatric care against their will by, again, somebody being a dick. Brian Doyle Murray was a character in that. He played the doctor for that facility. And he and Bill Murray, which turns out are brothers. Yeah. I did not know this. I felt stupid once I finally learned this because Doyle Murray hyphenated. Maybe they're half brothers. I don't know. I didn't go down the rabbit hole that far with the names. But Brian Doyle Murray, who you'll recognize as Mr. Shirley from Christmas Vacation, if you call yourself a movie fan, you know that reference.
Right.
He was also together with Brother Bill in Groundhog Day,
yep.
Caddyshack, and The Amazing Scrooged.
Yeah.
Man, what a series of films those two had together. But did they have many parts together? Not many.
And in Scrooged, I think that's his actual brother, the guy who plays his brother.
Oh, yeah.
That's the younger one. So Brian's the older one. And then the younger one, I'm looking it up. I mean, I'm
that's okay.
Thinking deeply. I will have it soon.
We have a lot of movie knowledge, but occasionally we find new things we've got to research on the fly, and this is a good one.
John Murray. Yeah, there he is. Yeah, so the
other brother.
Yeah, so the guy why don't they have a photo of him? Yeah, so the guy who plays Bill Murray's brother, you can picture him, right? Like
totally.
Is his actual brother in real life. So I guess I wonder if that's the only film all three of them are in. I think that he only has two brothers. I'm not sure if there's a fourth one.
Those three do not look anything like one another at all.
Yeah, that is strange. Brother from another mother.
Maybe. Yeah, well, I don't want to talk bad about their mother, but there might be some questions.
Mrs. Murray is a lovely woman.
Mrs. Murray. moving on through Ghostbusters 2, there's some, again, a couple of cool cameos that were in there that I think are worth shouting out. Cheech Marin has like one line at the docks about the Titanic.
Yep.
And Ben Stein, who we all know as the teacher from Ferris Bueller's Day Off and eventually the game show Ben Stein's Money, had a quick appearance in the film. I don't know if he even spoke. I think he was just handing out papers at a desk at one point.
Yeah, I don't remember if he had a line. Cheech only had the one line about the Titanic coming in, better late than never or something. Which apparently was given as a line to Bill Murray in the trailer. So they actually changed something up there. And
oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know why they gave it to Cheech
interesting.
Later. What, Cheech is
a
big draw
a long
or something? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, but you waste their abilities. They're both hilarious guys, and they get one line or no lines?
Yeah.
Really weird. Maybe it was just cut down from an original lengthier take. And then I had to ask myself this one. This is a really weird thing to point out. I noticed that their uniforms were upgraded in Ghostbusters 2. And again, I'm watching it for the, I don't know, fifth time at least. And you look on their patch is updated as well. Instead of just the Ghostbuster, it's now the emblem from Ghostbusters 2 where the Ghostbuster's holding out two fingers. And I really had to wonder, like, why? Why did they upgrade that patch for 2? Were they, is this a shout out to the fact they knew they were in a movie? It didn't seem that way.
It is a bit odd. It could be that it's also not just the number 2, but just kind of throwing the peace symbol like you do for photos back then. This is like before sticking your tongue out or the sideways piece or whatever everybody does now. But.
Maybe something to lighten up their brand a little bit as because they weren't needed or in the limelight anymore. Maybe they had been frowned upon by the city and many people.
I don't know. I mean, the whole concept of the movie, right, is to take a city that is, you know, enveloped in this negative attitude and bring peace to it so they all get along. So, I mean, I'm probably reaching there, but could be something like that. And they had...
maybe on some level they recognized the negative attitude of the city. Yeah.
Yeah, the uniforms, I know that they wanted to do an overhaul and they made them darker. And if you notice,
yep,
they're only darker in some of the movie, like halfway through or yep, earlier on, Reitman decided, yeah, I actually don't like that. And then he just switched back to the old uniforms without really talking about it, which you don't need to.
Weird.
They just have alternate uniforms like people would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Away and home.
Yeah, I think the original Ecto-1 was supposed to be black as well to look cool, but then they had all those night shots and it wouldn't show up, so they painted it white instead.
That it's not an unprecedented, even this day and age. If you watch Endgame, towards the end, War Machine comes out with a completely different armor, and there's no reference to him ever getting a different armor or an upgrade. Like, clearly that was probably something that was cut out of the film. Or, of course, the famous reference to the octopus and Goonies. I will probably reference that in every episode we ever record because it just stands out to me. I remember reading an article about that as a kid and being just blown away that we didn't get to see the octopus, you know?
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, it may not have been cut. I mean, I don't feel like we always need to be spoon-fed everything. I mean, I like when there's stuff like that where it's...
Yeah.
Because an audience isn't going to question everything. We're not going to be upset by everything. If the guy comes out with a new uniform, we're like, all right, well, I don't know the origin story of this uniform or who put it together, but he's got a new uniform. Cool. Whatever. Let's move on. Let's get to the meat of the story, you know?
Similar to the 501st Stormtroopers or 501st Star Wars fans that that do cosplay around the country, there are similar groups that do Ghostbusters cosplay, and they do screen-accurate uniforms and proton packs and stuff like that to the tune of thousands of dollars to get a proton pack built. But I bet there is an entire Wikipedia page website dedicated to those uniforms and exactly what they mean. And they probably have a million questions. It'd be interesting to have somebody explain that, but we don't have time for that today.
Yeah. Ain't nobody got time for that.
Exactly. And then finally, in my notes from Ghostbusters 2, I had to point this out. As a child of the 70s and 80s, gaming has always been very important to me. And one of the first game systems that we had as kids after the Atari was, of course, the Nintendo Entertainment System, the NES, or as our grandparents called it, the Nintendo. I still don't understand to this day why they called it the Nintendo, but... they at the end of Ghostbusters 2, when they go to control the Statue of Liberty, they break out the NES Advantage controller, which I think we had at one point when we were kids. I always looked up to that thing. I thought that was so cool because it was like having your own arcade at home to be able to play games on. If we didn't have, somebody we knew did.
I'm sure.
Because I did get to play on it quite a bit.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting in doing my research. Not only did it appear in the film, I wanted to see if there was any history or background as to why. I think this might have just been another marketing ploy by, you know, maybe a collab with Nintendo. But the NES Advantage controller also appeared in later comic books for Ghostbusters. Several issues. I guess they took the controller at the end of 2 and put it back on the shelf and then repurposed it for other things throughout the history of what is by many considered still canon in the Ghostbusters universe, those comic books. So I thought that was really cool.
So it's just an ongoing device that they can use for multiple different things.
Plus, how fun to tie it back in for your real fans to see if they catch and go, oh, that's the thing they used to control
that's
Statue
cool.
of Liberty.
Yeah, I like
that's
that.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah, like their what is it, the thing they have on Tully's head in the first one? It's just like a colander with wires coming out of it, and you know, it shows that he's like the dog in the background on the monitor or whatever.
So cool.
That's great. Yeah, I love it.
I saw somebody cosplay that at a show one time and nail it. It was perfect. It was one of my favorite cosplays I've ever seen.
That's great.
So good.
All right, so before we move on to talk about the upcoming Ghostbusters Afterlife, we're going to give our original pitches about what we would like to see a Ghostbusters movie be now.
Absolutely. Before we get to that, though, I do have a spot here for the secret code word that'll be used for a future giveaway. I think we came up with that code word. Do you remember what it was?
We did. It's Melnitz. You'll have to spell it.
Oh. M-E-L-N-I-T-Z, as in the name of Andy Potts' character, Janine Melnitz. So jot that down, keep that somewhere. It may not come into play today or this week, but eventually we'd like to do a giveaway, and you will be rewarded for having that info on hand. So
yeah. Type something, will you?
There you go.
We pay for this stuff. Just quit staring at me with the bug eyes. Janine, sorry about the bug eyes thing.
Type something. We're so good.
We're paying for this.
She's just sitting there doing like a word, a crossword or something. And looks at him over the glasses.
All right. So I think you've been going first on pitches yep. the last couple of times. So I'm going to go. And despite what I just said, this is actually not going to be a movie. I'm breaking the mold a little bit here. So rather than doing a true sequel, which most of ours have been up to this point, I'm going to sidestep and make this a television series. I'm also going to take it even farther, where this is a real world, in quotes, television series where Ghostbusters exists in the movies as we already know it. So that's pretty much the tie-in. There's going to be some stuff in how they handle the crew and the gadgets and stuff, so that will be similar to how it's handled in the movies that we know, but that's about it. Everything else is going to be original. And the concept here, I want to be kind of what I said earlier, where I think Ghostbusters 2 should have been a ramp up in the scare factor. I want to do that as well. So this television series is going to be equal parts scare and comedy. So there's still going to be a ton of jokes, but it's going to be quite frightening, and the effects. I want to be something that it's not safe for kids. This is going to be an adult show. All right, so the concept that goes behind this is that ghosts, as they're viewed now, there's two sides. There's believers and non-believers, but the concern over the ghost's existence is not really anything threatening. You know, it doesn't really matter if they exist or not. That is, until a ghost not only clearly appears on Dax Higgins' paranormal investigation show, but kidnaps one of his crew on camera. She is clawed at, beaten, and dragged screaming into the darkness. Dax, played by Channing Tatum, the tough guy ghost hunter who challenges and berates spirits and demons to force their attention, has spent years investigating the paranormal on his moderately popular television show, but has found little actual evidence to prove his paranormal insinuations and theories. After the horrific episode where his colleague is taken, however, the world is focused on the disappearance of his crew, and even with doubters shouting fraud, new ghost encounters are popping up all over. Dax, with the help of his co-host Daryl Dancer, a hapless fool who gets continually volunteered for the worst and scariest assignments, played by Jonah Hill, are excited at the surge in ratings for their show, but freaked out by the event, acknowledging that they are in way over their heads. Luckily, an eccentric scientist whose inventions dip into the realms of death and demons sees the program and contacts the boys. The scientist, Curtis Pine, played by Lawrence Fishburne, is even scarier than the ghosts, often shouting into the dark, wielding a weapon that looks like an old wizard's staff shored up with tiny electric gadgets. The three get a tip that a ghost similar to the one from their previous episode was seen several times at a haunted old bar in Kentucky, and they set off to investigate. At the bar, they encounter paranormal mayhem. They are chased by ghosts, attacked by demons, and appeared far out of their element until the crazy scientist Curtis comes back from his van with a string of hula hoops wrapped in wire and more small gadgets. He sets up what becomes a ghost trap, and the tide appears to be turning in their favor until they see their kidnapped colleague writhing in the hula trap. Dax and Daryl attempt to extract her, but Curtis screams to let her go. Dax, in his macho overkill style, pulls the hoops apart, breaking the ghost trap. As the device shoots death rattle sparks, the guys are shocked to see that their colleague has emerged, though clearly she has been altered by the experience. Sarah Tyler, played by Olivia Munn, is scarred, covered in ectoplasm, and her eyes pulse with swirling light. The ghosts are gone, and with some alerts from Curtis's strange staff, he informs them all that the ghosts are trapped inside Sarah. She tells them that something is happening in the paranormal realm, and the dead are escaping, fleeing, in fact, from some evil that is no longer content to torture the dead. While many of the ghosts are harmless, some of them need to be sent back to hell, along with whatever else is breaching the boundaries between Earth and the afterlife. The four decide to be partners, not just in documenting the paranormal phenomenon sweeping the planet, but in doing their part to protect the living from what seeks to threaten them. And so for the series, we're going to get a lot more about Curtis and his past, a lot more crazy gadgets. I wanted to kind of set the tone early on with him especially, that this is kind of a fantasy thing where all kinds of you never know what's coming, and when it does, you're okay with it because we've set the tone early on that anything could pop out of the darkness and they could battle all kinds of stuff later on. It sets us up to allow all kinds of adventures for them to go on, and different, you know, sort of malevolent beings to take on in combat. I'd like to have Sarah, Olivia Munn's character, she figures out how to sort of wield her ghosts that are inside her, each with sort of different abilities and stuff, where she can kind of shoot them out of her hands or eyes or whatever. And so she kind of has ghosts as, you know, her powers and stuff. And so I think that'd be a lot of fun. And there'd probably be some tension between her and Curtis, where, you know, he's basically been trying to fight demons and ghosts all this time, and she's part of that, and so that would be a fun thing. And I really think that the whole casting with Channing and Hill, Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill, would be a lot of fun, because I really enjoyed him in 21 Jump Street, and I just think they're both good comedians separate, but together they made a really good team. So I think that'd be a lot of fun with them.
Well, I mean, first of all, bonus points for Olivia Munn, because I'd watch anything she's in.
Yeah.
Wow, just gorgeous. But yeah, the casting of those two guys, I love 21 Jump Street. And one of my favorite things in film all time was the series of sequels that they pitched in poster form at the end of 22 Jump Street. Maybe the only redeeming quality of that movie. And I don't know if you know this, but years ago, I believe it was Sony, had actually greenlit one of the sequels to 22 Jump Street that they kind of pitched at the end, which was a Jump Street Men in Black crossover. And they were moving forward with this thing. It was going to happen, where the guys were going to become Men in Black. And I so badly wanted to see that. Like, that would have been comedy genius.
Yeah.
But for some reason, after they got into early development, they canned the concept.
That
and
stinks.
Oh man, what a loss.
I would have liked that too. And that introduces some cool ideas. Why not? Why can't we do more crossover things with successful movies? That'd be a lot of fun.
I'd love to see it. I mean, look what the MCU did with the shared universe against all of their own films. Why not take successful A and successful B and make super successful C? Mm-hmm. I think that would be so much fun. You bring in these audiences from different backgrounds. I'd watch that in a heartbeat. I would, if they put up a Kickstarter for that right now, I would help fund that.
Yeah.
Like Super Troopers did for their sequel.
Yeah. Like I, when Freddy versus Jason came out, I thought, what a cool concept. And I really liked the movie. I don't know if everybody likes that movie, but I do. I think it's a lot of fun. And having those two characters duke it out and stuff, that was a cool concept. And I had heard they were supposed to do one a follow-up with Ash. They were gonna have Freddy versus Jason versus Ash, but I don't think that got anywhere.
That would be epic.
We at least got the Ash TV series, and that was really good.
I saw earlier today or yesterday evening that Sam Raimi, going real off subject here, Sam Raimi's been confirmed to direct Doctor Strange 2 Into the Madness or whatever it's called. And so already you've got, Ash pitching publicly. He's like, well, I'll play the villain in the movie if you need somebody. I'm ready. Bruce Campbell.
Yeah.
He's amazing, by the way. One of the best guys to see at a panel at a con ever. He ends up hosting his own game show in his panels.
Oh, yeah.
And he is so smart.
Yeah, the one I went to with you here in Ottawa had him in there.
Oh, is that where it was?
Yeah, that's where it was. That was a lot of fun.
Where he was messing with the kid on stage?
Yeah.
There was like a 12-year-old boy who was like would say stuff, and he was just really giving him a hard time. Yeah. It was really funny.
Yeah, he was good. I really like him, and I can't remember if I mentioned this movie before or not, but Bubba Hotep. Did you ever watch that one?
Oh, yeah, that's a crazy one where he plays like old Elvis or whatever.
Yeah. That's a really good movie. Like, it's way better than I thought it would be, and that's a lot of fun, too. If you haven't checked that one out, you should probably go check that one out.
I love Army of Darkness.
Yeah, it's still a classic.
Yeah.
I can't say that I'm excited, though, for Sam Raimi to do the Doctor Strange movie, because I feel like his style belongs with a certain genre. Like, in the horror realm, it works really well. And I remember when the Spider-Mans came out, I was excited to see him direct something different.
Yeah.
But, and even then, I think I liked them. I really liked Tobey Maguire, so I think that helped quite a bit. They were good movies, but watching them now, I don't like them nearly as much.
Well, interestingly enough, Doctor Strange 2 is being pitched as the first MCU horror film.
Okay.
It has been for months since before they agreed to bring him on as director. So,
okay.
Could be interesting.
Well, then maybe he's very fitting for the part. Because
yeah, they're good at picking their directors.
Because as horror being the main focus with his weird, you know, zooms and cuts and campy yep. sort of style, it I don't know, it makes a different sort of tone. So that might work very well then. Yeah, cool.
Well, I derailed us horribly. I'm sorry about that. But so that was your pitch. Did you have a title? Did you say the title?
It's just going to be called Ghostbusters. The series is going to be called Ghostbusters. I kind of wanted to,
okay.
I wanted to have a gag, though, where they never actually, like, the team talks about having a name, but it's never actually Ghostbusters. Like, they just use these offshoots ones. I think it's in our trivia where they have the alternate names and stuff where it's like Ghost Smashers or, you know, Ghost Grabbers or something like that. And so I think it'd be funny to where they never actually use the name Ghostbusters other than the title of the show.
Yeah, I like that. Because that's one of the things that always gets me is when they have to say the title of a thing in the movie in a place where it doesn't really make a lot of sense. Like in Ghostbusters, makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
They needed a name for what they were doing, but some of these other ones, like, oh, you forced that. Why'd you say the title of the movie? Come on.
Yeah, it's always a drinking game sort of thing. Oh, they said the title. Everybody take a shot.
Yep.
Yeah.
Too good. All right, is it time for the big Sully pitch?
It is. Lay it
on.
All
right. Pitch, please. All right, here we go. Before I get into it all, just a little warning. I know there are video games in the Ghostbusters world and comic books that are considered canon by many fans. I am not well-versed on those. While I have played some of the games, I have not read the comics. So my focus, much as it seems that they are leading to with the third film that they're officially making, is just on Ghostbusters 1, Ghostbusters 2, and this third film. Anything else, I'm not playing into. Title of mine, I am going to stick with the title Ghostbusters Afterlife, and I am going to stick with the film. I like the title, and I'll be honest, I may have had a hard time breaking in my mind the connection that I already have with the sequel, because I have been excited for a long time, and I liked the teaser trailer, and I liked the full official trailer, and I have read a couple things before knowing we were going to do this podcast. So some of this might have leaked over from the trailer I've already seen is what I'm getting at. Director, I'd like to keep Ivan Reitman. Jason Reitman, a wonderful director. He's great. I love Juno, one of my favorite films. But I like the idea of keeping a director, especially if you've got a formula that works, and I think we do in Ghostbusters 1 and 2, so I want Ivan back. I'd like the stars to still be our main core, Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, Ernie Hudson, Sigourney Weaver, Rick Moranis, and Annie Potts. I want them all back. I feel like they can all still offer something to this world as they possibly hand off to someone else. Here is the Big Sully pitch. 31 years after the events of Ghostbusters 2, the Ghostbusters once again find themselves disbanded due to a lack of business. They clearly did too good of a job eliminating the ghost threat that had plagued New York not once, but twice. The core team of Venkman, Stant, Spengler, Zeddemore, along with Dana Barrett, Louis Tully, and Janine Melnitz, have all gone their separate ways. For the first time in years, our heroes are brought back together for the funeral of their good friend, Dr. Egon Spengler. They all attend the funeral in upstate New York, where Egon had married and had children. At the funeral and after, the team catches up a bit and chats with Egon's wife about the weird circumstances surrounding his death. She is unsure just what happened to Egon, but hints at the fact that he had been researching the paranormal for years on his own and had been increasingly excited as of late. Stance and Zeddemore decide to investigate Egon's passing and convince Venkman that he should join them. Tully, who's been reading and studying the occult and researching ghosts for years now, joins the team, even though they try to discourage it. They start at Egon's house in his barn/research facility. It's clear by the photos and red string, movie law, that Egon has been researching a phenomenon that has appeared not only in New York, but around the world. Egon's research, as found and recapped vocally by the team, also movie law, had continued to focus on human emotions and how the paranormal could affect or be affected by them. Graphs and charts on the walls of his research barn clearly show that the anger levels around the world had been increasing over the last 3 decades, and he found a link to the paranormal. One common thread was the internet, and Egon was convinced that a singular spirit or entity has somehow using this the web to slowly increase the hostility and anger of people all over the world. His studies often involve interviews with the angriest of them all, internet trolls. During their own research and investigation, a ghost, unseen by the team but definitely seen by the viewers of the film, helps to nudge Tully towards some clues, moving objects, hitting keys on the keyboard, whispering in his ear, etc. The team eventually finds that the hottest spots to investigate are internet exchange points around the world where the majority of internet traffic goes through, and they head to CoreSite NE2, a facility in good old New York, to investigate. I didn't come up with that name, that's the actual name of a site. Mm. At the facility, the team finds the employees there are all a little off and especially angry. Even for native New Yorkers, the behavior of these employees seems a bit much. Through a series of events, mishaps, and plenty of colorful banter from Venkman, they determine that spirits have started to take over the employees there and at other exchange points around the world. Their snooping and discovery leads to the big bad, a Buffy the Vampire Slayer term, of the movie to reveal him or herself. Fast forward. How do you fight a ghost that's taken over the internet? You go into the internet. The team goes into a Ghostbusters video game created almost 10 years before and takes control of their digital selves, using VR to fight the big bad. Tully actually takes over the Egon character and fights alongside the team. Of course, not being video game players, the team has some early mishaps, but eventually they figure it out. While in the game, they recruit other players and even some ghosts, hello Slimer cameo, to help them in their struggle and eventually go head-to-head with the big bad, an actual giant troll doll, complete with huge, brightly colored hair. That leads right into the merchandising. You're welcome. The team puts up the fight of their lives and, of course, comes out on top. The big bad is trapped and harnessed in a digital containment unit courtesy of Egon's son, who is helping from outside the video game and walking the team through some of the finer points of their video game play. Upon exiting the game, the team celebrates their victory, but something's off. Tully, who is usually weird enough, seems really out of it and doesn't remember much of what happened during the events of their epic struggle against the giant troll. They all comment about what an amazing job he did as Egon, but he just can't piece it together. A quick shot at the end shows the spirit of Egon rising up out of Tully's body, only seen by the audience. So Egon was there with the team the whole time, just unknowingly. They didn't know. The Ghostbusters saved the world again, but this go-round was a little different. This time, the events of this entire big battle against the troll were live-streamed on sites like Twitch, Mixer, and YouTube to every corner of the globe. The world, now void of this extra negativity forced on by these spirits, becomes a happier place, and an entire generation of fans are armed with the knowledge and ability to fight these ghosts, should they, when they, eventually reappear.
Hmm. Very nice.
So there's my pitch. I like the idea of a big bad that is much bigger than the previous films.
Yeah.
And I like the idea that they hinted at it, especially in 2, that New York seemed especially angry, and they played on how the slime could go positive or negative depending on the people around them. So the idea of the entire world getting angrier because of the internet, which that's true, right? We have a chance to fight it. So maybe there's a chance for us all to win by banding together and learning something from Ghostbusters Afterlife.
Yeah, that's cool. It's so funny. Every time I think of the internet in movies, it goes back to the 80s where it was like E equals MC squared flying by and skull and crossbones or something, or, you know, random lines cross. It's always so lame. And in newer movies, like how it's treated, I think what the only thing I can think of is like Wreck-It Ralph is this new introduction of, you know, what is the internet for movies. So it'd be cool to see that again, another treatment of what that looks like and stuff.
I like the Chappelle Show, like when he talks about if the mall were more like the internet, you go in and all those ads are thrown at you, and there's a whole bunch of adult stores, and or you go, what was one of the real lame representations was either Lawnmower Man with the VR or Hackers.
Oh, Hackers.
The way they established the internet in Hackers was crazy.
Yeah. Didn't it just always have code going across the screen or something like that? That's so dumb.
Just a steady stream of digital stuff.
Yeah, Hackers is one of those that just perpetuated this idea where somebody's sitting down and constantly typing a computer, which would be the exact opposite. They've already written the code. They just hit enter or run or whatever. You know, it's like, it's just going to execute, like, EXE. You know, you just put it out there, and then you sit back and, you know, wait. You're not going to be constantly typing. Why would that happen? It's ridiculous.
That'd be a great internet short to break down, like, what it is in movies versus what it is in real life.
Yeah. Yeah, I've watched very briefly one of these actual hacker contests. You know, they'll film, and I'm not going to say televise it. They'll have, like, these conferences or whatever where it will be something there. And it's so boring. Like, they try and make it exciting, but it's not. It's just not an exciting thing to watch because it's a computer program running. Like, yeah, it doesn't work.
It's just about the outcome.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I like that. I think both of us also did something where both of the other, I mean, you still are in New York, but you're also worldwide. Where Ghostbusters 1 and 2 was very isolated to New York. Like, the threat was always there. It wasn't a worldwide threat, and realizing that makes you understand how possible it was, where after the first one, even though they saved the city, it didn't affect the world, and at the time, like, not everybody was filming, it wasn't on the phones, it wasn't on the internet, so it is possible to understand how they could have been dismissed so much by 5 years later being, you know, hacks and frauds and stuff, and that even when they did it again in the second one, we could totally understand that they would be right back, you know, in the gutter again, and not having any money or any work for them as Ghostbusters. So this changing it to a worldwide phenomenon where everyone is not only aware of them, but possibly the threat is worldwide as well, changes the game.
Yeah, I mean, the events of 1 and 2, because of the time, like you said, everybody didn't have a cell phone. They weren't all shooting. Even the news stations would have been slow to the tick to get there to capture. Well, I mean, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, the whole scene in IRL would have lasted like 5 to 10 minutes. They may not have even had time to get cameras out. And if one did get out, it could be debunked just like the moon landing, how people are trying to do that with the moon landing as, oh, this was some sort of special effect that you put on. That couldn't be real, you know?
It's not possible. All right, cool. So those are our pitches. I don't think either one of those are going to be what happens in Ghostbusters Afterlife. I think we already know that.
No.
But that's the fun of this whole thing. And so if you have a pitch idea, if you have a concept, be sure to throw one at us for now and all future episodes. It's going to be a lot of fun. And we'll get to the point where we actually might get those in advance and read them, you know, the winning pitch on the episode. So what is going to happen with the actual Ghostbusters Afterlife? Well, here's what we know so far. After being evicted from their home, two children and their single mother moved to a farm in Somerville, Oklahoma, inherited from their late grandfather. When the town experiences a series of unexplained earthquakes, the children discover their families linked to the original Ghostbusters, who have become something of a myth, as many have long since forgotten the events of the Manhattan cross-rip of 1984 and the secret legacy that their grandfather left behind. We get a lot of the original cast in this, actually. We've got Sigourney Weaver, Bill Murray, Annie Potts, Dan Aykroyd, Ernie Hudson. We also get some new folks. Paul Rudd is going to be in there. Carrie Coon, who played Proxima Midnight in the Avengers Endgame and Infinity War. She had some makeup, so we wouldn't have recognized her in that, but she was also in Fargo television series, as well as The Leftovers. We also get Bokeem Woodbine, who was in The Rock, or Riddick, Spider-Man Homecoming. And for the kids, McKenna Grace, she was in Troop Zero, Captain Marvel, Annabelle Comes Home, Ready Player One, I, Tonya, Independence Day, Resurgence. I mean, this girl's only 13, and that's that's massive. She's like, she's doing all right.
She can retire now if she wants.
Yeah, she's done it all. Finn Wolfhard, great name, by the way. Like, that's his actual name, Finn Wolfhard. Dang.
Sounds like a UFC fighter.
Yeah. We all know him as Mike Wheeler on Stranger Things. He was also in the It 1 and 2. And that kid's great. Like, I'll pretty much see anything he's in. He's very likable. This is directed, as you said earlier, by Jason Reitman, who's Ivan Reitman's son. And I don't think we talked about it. Jason Reitman's actually the kid in Ghostbusters 2, his party at the beginning. He's that jerk kid who'd rather see He-Man there. So when the Ghostbusters That's show great. Up, he's all disappointed. He directed Juno, as you mentioned. He also did Up in the Air, Young Adult, Labor Day, and Tully, of all names. I remember way back in the day when I was at A&M, we did the Texas Independent Film Festival, and I got to see a lot of the submissions that people would send in. And he sent in his first short called Operation. And it was like a black and white, maybe 20 minutes or something. And it was, if you remember, one of those sort of wives' tale stories about people getting kidnapped in Mexico or wherever, and they wake up in the bathtub full of ice and their kidney's been taken out. That's what this story was about. And it was very funny, very entertaining. And I was really excited to see his work then and since then. I'm a big fan. I like Juno. Up in the Air is fantastic. Tully was really good as well. And so I'm anxious to see more from him. And I like the idea that this is a, you know, passing the baton, not only if the kids in the movie were moving on from the old Ghostbusters to the new generation, and we're doing that as well with the direction. So I think it's pretty cool that he's doing this. For writing, Jason Reitman helped write it as well. He had also written Up in the Air, Labor Day, Thank You for Smoking, The Front Runner. Those are some other movies he directed as well. Gil Keenan is joining him as a writer. Now, this is only one of two of his writing projects. Both are in post-production, so not well-known as a writer. He did, however, direct a few things. He directed Monster House, 2006. It's like an animated movie that I do remember seeing, and it was very good. City of Ember, 2008, sort of a fantasy dystopian future thing, which I don't remember much about of it, but I do remember it looking pretty cool, but I really couldn't tell you the story. And Poltergeist, the 2015 remake, which is very disappointing, as I think everybody would agree. And, you know, you deserve it, because how dare you make Poltergeist? It's already a perfect film, and you're going to go and say that we need a remake? No, sir. So, yeah, you've upset me. This is going to be released March 5th, 2021. Even though there's trailers and stuff now, you're going to be waiting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just sitting there, finished, waiting.
Now, I know you said you'd rather have Ivan directing, but I mean, what do you think of Jason doing this?
I don't know. I do have a little story I was going to say to the very end, but I think now is the good time to bring it in. I was at Toy Fair. Actually, this is part of the story. I was at Toy Fair, which is a big industry thing, earlier this year in January, before all this broke out, where everybody tries to pimp out their toys for all the big companies for the rest of the year. And Ivan Reitman was there on stage to talk about Ghostbusters to an audience. I was not in the audience, but caught the second hand. And I guess after a few minutes of discussion, people were asking him, like, oh, well, your dad did the first two, making all these connections, asking him questions. He's like, well, you know what? Let's just bring my dad out. So Ivan Reitman was there as well, and he came out on stage. And I read that Ivan is a producer on the film, his son directing, but apparently he was around through a lot of this. So I like the concept that maybe it was more of a collaborative effort with Jason eventually getting the handoff and taking over the reins for future films. So maybe Ivan still had a big hand in all this. So maybe we're kind of getting the best of both worlds.
Yeah, that's cool. That'll be good. All right, so you've stuck around for a while. We're going to do some trivia fun facts from the films. And these are a lot of fun. A lot of this stuff is pulled from IMDb. We try and get it from other resources. But I love this kind of stuff, all the behind the scenes things. And
same.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's part of why we're doing this podcast, is because we like to talk about all those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's fun to do a deep dive and learn some new things. Because, I mean, while that's there, how many people bother to scroll that far down on an IMDb page? It's usually to find out an actor's name real quick. You don't usually get this deep in the weeds. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go. Let's hit it up. Trivia, first one on the board. Dan Aykroyd conceived Ghostbusters as a project for him, Eddie Murphy, and John Belushi, where they would travel through time and space to combat a host of demonic and supernatural threats. Belushi died in 1982 as Aykroyd was working on the script. Hmm. And I hate to derail it this early, but I was listening to a great podcast with Dan Aykroyd recently. I believe it was the Mark Maron WTF podcast. And he was talking about this very thing. And he said that he was working on that script when he got the call from a friend that Belushi had died. And the first question he asked was, does his wife know? And they said no. So he took it upon himself to go and break the news to her and be the first person on the scene and to console her, because they had been so close. And I thought that was, wow, that's some heavy, heavy stuff right there.
Yeah, that's really sad for a lot of different reasons. But yeah, that's super sad. Reitman was given a green light with a due date of June of 1984. This left him 13 months to complete the film. He had no script, no special effects studio, and very loose casting. Bill Murray still hadn't, like, totally committed to this thing. So,
wow.
Yeah, sure. I'll go ahead and just
whip out that movie. He deserves, like, a Nobel Peace Prize for pulling that off. Yeah. Several titles were considered for the film, since Ghostbusters was legally restricted by the 1970s children's show The Ghostbusters, two words, owned by Universal Studios. Some options included Ghost Stoppers, Ghost Breakers, and Ghost Smashers. Ugh. Fortunately, Price had parted ways with Columbia early in the Ghostbusters production and became head of Universal, at which point he allowed Columbia to have the title. God, just worked out perfect.
Yeah, I looked out on that one. Otherwise, we'd be singing Ghost Smashers. John Candy was offered the role of Lewis Tully. Reitman recalled it was a few days before Candy called him back to say he did not understand the character. Candy suggested portraying Tully with a German accent and multiple German shepherds, but the filmmakers felt there were already enough dogs in the film. Reitman was already aware of Rick Moranis from their work together in Toronto and sent him the script. He called Reitman back about an hour later and accepted the part, saying he understood the character completely. And boy, did he. And I'll read the next one, too, because it just ties into it. When Lewis Tully mingles with his party guests, commenting on the price of the salmon and so on, that scene is one continuous shot and almost entirely improvised.
Wow.
And if you haven't watched it,
that is impressive.
That is impressive. Like, the stuff he rambles on about is hilarious.
How do you do that in character? Like, I would fumble over my words so bad. I can barely read these words on the screen without fumbling. And he's just rattling off, like, oh, this is such and such and his wife, and they just paid off their mortgage, and she's living off a deferred unemployment.
Yeah.
Like, just so funny, man.
Yeah.
I love John Candy. I can't think of another movie where I'd be like, oh, no, John Candy wouldn't have been great in that. Tully. Freaking Moranis owned this character. He made it his own.
Yeah, he was perfect. That was perfect casting.
They only had one Ektomobile to film with, a 25-year-old Cadillac, so extra care was taken to keep the car intact for the filming. Luckily, the car held on through main production, finally breaking down on the Manhattan Bridge during final shooting.
Well, that's part of that whole rushed thing, right? Like, I guess... They got one car. They didn't have time to build more of them. They're like, we've got 13 months. Yeah. Just get it out there and start filming.
God.
The role of the Sumerian god Gozer the Gozerian was originally intended for Paul Rubens. Envisioned as a business-suited architect, Rubens passed on the idea and it went to Yugoslavian actress Slavica Jovan. The role changed to one inspired by the androgynous looks of Grace Jones and David Bowie. So Pee Wee Herman would have been the big bad
in this. I can't even fathom. I'm sure, like you hinted at, like makeup and all that stuff probably would have solved it, but I'd still be like, that's freaking Pee Wee Herman up there.
Yeah. Well, and I'd seen him in, what was it? was it a Cheech and Chong movie? I think he was in there, and his whole line is always something like hamburgers or something, and he just does a bunch of cocaine all the time. He's just freaking crazy in that movie. He's a strange one. So I don't know how he would have done this character if it would have been doing his typical Pee-wee sort of behavior.
Or it might have been such a departure. He might have done something different. It would have changed his career permanently.
Yeah.
Could have been very different. In the months before its debut, a teaser trailer was released focused on the No Ghosts logo, helping the icon to become recognizable far in advance and generating interest in the film without mentioning its title or its stars. A separate theatrical trailer for the film contained a functional toll-free telephone number with a message by Murray and Aykroyd waiting for the 1,000 callers per hour it received over a 6-week period.
Hmm.
Wow.
That's great.
Bold. I think you and I as kids, I remember having these conversations. We actually talked about like doing movie reviews or how we thought there should be an all-hero network, which we have now.
Yeah.
But one of the things we talked about was if you've got a solid movie and a solid premise, like the 89 Batman, just put up the logo on a poster, put it out, and you don't even need trailers. People will come and watch these films and word of mouth will continue to deliver. I think Ghostbusters could have been the same, but maybe not. Maybe it wouldn't have been enough.
Yeah, I don't know. Murray left acting for 4 years following the release of Ghostbusters. He described the film's success as a phenomenon that would forever be his biggest accomplishment, and compounded by the failure of his personal project, The Razor's Edge, he felt radioactive. He chose to avoid making movies until 1988 when he appeared in the Christmas comedy film Scrooged. Scrooged even traded in a Ghostbusters' popularity in its marketing, using the tagline that Murray was back among the ghosts.
That's actually really smart.
Yeah, I'm glad he came back.
No kidding.
That's weird.
Scrooge is a Christmas staple.
Yeah.
You got to watch that every year.
Yeah. Well, now that we know all the Murray brothers are in it, too, it's extra fun.
Yeah, it is. The character of Winston was meant to have joined the team much earlier and would have been slimed at the hotel. When Eddie Murphy declined the role, however, the script was rewritten to have Winston appear about halfway through the film.
After Harold Ramis passed away, fans of the movie paid tribute to him by visiting the New York City firehouse used in the exterior shots and created a makeshift memorial featuring Nestle's Crunch Bars in reference to Venkman giving Spengler a candy bar, and Twinkies in reference to Spengler using the Twinkie to describe the ghost problem in New York City.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's great.
On the set, Dan Aykroyd referred to the Slimer ghost as the ghost of John Belushi. Slimer's gluttonous eating was based on Belushi's cafeteria scene in National Lampoon's Animal House.
Look, I'm a pimple.
Wow.
Dana's apartment building actually exists at 55 Central Park West in New York City. In real life, the building is 20 stories high. For the film, matte paintings and models were used to make the building look bigger and with more floors. So it's probably just a boring big rectangle.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've seen it. It didn't have those distinguishing looks of the top floors. I didn't know what I was looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Next time I go, I want to track that down, though. All right, moving on to some cool trivia for Ghostbusters 2. Max von Sydow provided the voice of Viggo. He completed his recordings in a single day. Wilhelm von Humberg, who eventually played Viggo, reported only learned his voice had been dubbed with von Sydow's while watching the premiere and stormed out shortly afterward. Oh, God.
That's going to suck.
What a slap in the face.
Yeah.
If they don't warn you, like, it'd be different if they told you up front, but to find out at the premiere, I'd have left too.
Yeah, that would be upsetting. Well, at least he was in the movie. Like, what was it? I read somebody else had a role. I can't remember who it was now. They had a role in the movie, and it was cut out at some point. Oh, I want to say it was Eugene Levy had a part, and then they cut it out. It wasn't a huge thing, but it was, you know.
Huh.
Still, that sucks. Because they don't tell you. I've heard that story several times from people. They go to the premiere, they are in the movie, or they were, and then their part isn't in the movie anymore, and they were not aware.
Wow.
So I don't know. Now I'm picturing like these final cuts coming down to like the last minute, which maybe
it does.
Maybe that happens.
From what I've heard.
In an interview in Starlog 148, Peter McNichol revealed that in the first script, he saw the character of Janos Poha was a rather lackluster villain called Jason. McNichol suggested making the art restorer come from Carpathia, which is why he's an expert on the painting of Viggo. During filming, McNichol spent a lot of time in his trailer creating Janos' origin and accent, as well as a mythology for Carpathia. He even came up with his own vision for the Carpathian flag, which featured a snake stepping on a man.
Wow.
That guy gets
deep into character. Because the cartoon The Real Ghostbusters, 1986, was so popular among children, Ivan Reitman, Dan Aykroyd, and Harold Ramis made a conscious effort to tone down the adult innuendo and behaviors from the original Ghostbusters. All of the Ghostbusters gave up smoking, except for a few scenes where Ray has a cigar pipe in his hand or in his mouth, and the ghosts took an appearance closer to those in the animated series rather than the more frightening effects of the first film. You kind of mentioned that earlier. I kind of see it now. After reading that, it makes sense.
Yeah. And the New York police officer that receives the report of the Titanic's arrival says the call is coming from Pier 34. In real life, that was the ship's original destination. Almost made it.
A scene where patrons run out of a movie theater as slime oozes from the area has cannibal girls on the marquee with Eugene Levy and Andrea Martin showing off. The film was one of Ivan Reitman's first films as a director, and it a shout out to that Eugene Levy you just talked about.
I don't think I've ever seen that, and I probably won't, but...
Same.
I don't know. Maybe I should put it on the list. Who knows? It might be good. In 1975, Filmation, the animation company behind He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, produced The Ghostbusters, a live-action series about two men and a gorilla who hunt for ghosts. When Ghostbusters, the movie, was released in theaters 9 years later, Columbia Pictures had to buy the rights to the title from Filmation. Filmation then capitalized on the film's popularity by producing the original Ghostbusters based on their earlier series. To avoid confusion, the animated series based on the film was called The Real Ghostbusters.
Sure, that's not confusing at all.
Yeah.
To avoid confusion.
There's like 300 different Ghostbusters variants, so nobody knows what's happening. And somewhere there's a gorilla in one of them.
We're far from done. We're going to get more. And finally, the large Vigo painting is actually a photograph and hangs in the offices at Industrial Light and Magic. I never would have guessed. It looked perfectly like a painting.
I hope they made it where like the eyes actually follow you, like those, you know, it moves around.
I mean, I was kind of impressed by the 3D look of like when his face stretches out and looks around at one point. That looked really good for the time. I'm not quite sure how they did that, honestly.
Yeah, there's still good effects in there. Like, mm-hmm. I think, if anything, the effects in the second one, they're both fairly on par with one another, but I think I still like the first one better for effects.
Yeah.
Different tone.
Well, that ends the trivia facts, but I do have a couple of random behind the scenes things. Try to wrap this up here in a couple of minutes. This movie or movies, Ghostbusters 1 and 2, have been a part of my life since I was a kid, and I don't think it'll ever not be a part of my life. I think I'll watch these films many more times. But forever a thread of pop culture and my life, it's been interesting, the run-ins I've had with it. In 2017, January, I was in L.A. for the premiere of the Funko documentary called Making Fun, and one of the things we did was we went over to the famous Big Boy Burger place. Everybody knows Big Boy. And when we went in, put our name on the list, turned around, there's Ernie Hudson. Mm. Winston Zeddemore standing right there with his family. I so badly, like inside, I'm screaming, it's Winston. And I wanted to go say hi to him, but he was with his family and I didn't want to be that guy. That mealtime is one time you don't interrupt people. And so I never saw an opening, but it was cool to be in the same area with him. And he looked great. I mean, he doesn't look like he's aged that much over the years. He looks really good.
Hmm. That's great.
I mentioned this earlier. Mark Maron has a great recent episode with Dan Aykroyd where he talks about Ghostbusters and many other things. But one of the things I found really interesting is he talked about his family's ties to the occult and how they've studied for years and they have books and that they made a conscious effort to bring ectoplasm into common everyday like pop culture and made it famous with Ghostbusters. But that's something that no one really knew about. That gooey substance until the movie came out. But I guess he and his family have known about it for a long time.
Hmm.
And finally, I told one part of the story, but didn't tell the second part. Jason Reitman was at Toy Fair that I was at back in January of this year. And I know he was on stage and I didn't get to see him. But hours later, I'm touring a guy through the booth, showing him all the new stuff at Funko. And he just puts his hand up, the guy I'm touring, and basically is like, stop talking. And he looks behind me and he goes, right behind you, there's a man I want to get my photograph with. And it was Jason Reitman. And I had no clue. I had walked right past him. I think I'd even looked at him, and it just didn't register. I feel stupid now for having not caught it. But the guy who was I was touring said, I want a photo with him. Can you help me out? And I was like, sure, I'll take it. So I hold up his camera he hands me, an actual camera, not a phone. I go to take the photo several times, thought I was taking the photo. And as I hand the camera back to this guy I was touring through, I was like, hey, can you check it and make sure those are good? He looks and goes, no, you didn't actually take any photos. You got to hold this button down longer. Luckily, Jason hadn't left and was kind enough to hang around for some additional photos. And then he and this guy were talking, and the guy I'm touring was like, hey, so what do you think? Are Ghostbusters 3 going to be as amazing as the first two or something to that effect? And Jason Reitman was like, hey, you know, I think it's great. I did a good job. It's going to be up to the audience, though. So we'll all have to wait and see. And unfortunately, that means till March of 2021 now. But it's too long.
Yeah, that's a long time. But I will be going to see that one for sure. And
amen. Yep.
Yeah, I think it's going to be pretty good. Well, thank you again for joining us on Movie Retakes. If you didn't listen to my earlier instructions, right now hit that subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter or wherever else, or stalk us in our backyard. I don't care. Just be a fan. And we appreciate you coming by. And join us for the next episode.
Wait, do you hear that?
What is that sound? Oh, get your gear on, man.
One thing.
Yeah.
We got to go.
It's time.
Later on.
They had a real big problem with some big, mean local gold.